Well, another day, another Nobel Prize winning economist. Yesterday, Paul Krugman was on our show from The Green Space. Today, we have George Akerlof, co-author of the book Animal Spirits, which we are told that President Obama has been reading this year. The title is a reference to something that John Maynard Keynes wrote in the 1930s, but it may apply to today in terms of looking beyond rational decision-making to our animal spirits to repair the economy as well as our personal finances. George Akerlof is a professor of economics at UC Berkeley. He won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2001, and he's the co-author of Animal Spirits, How Human Psychology Drives the Economy and Why It Matters for Global Capitalism. Professor Akerlof, welcome to WNYC. Good morning from New York.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
We know that Keynes wrote about the need for government spending to maximize growth, but most people don't know that he wrote about animal spirits. What was the reference?
The reference to animal spirits is that people simply don't know how to make an investment, and you can't look at the probabilities of different payoffs and everything. You just have to be straight from the gut. You have to somehow look at the investment and sort of make a decision whether to do that. And so that's how he says most people make their investment decisions. It applies to their animal spirits.
But I guess unlike, he's no Malcolm Gladwell, right? Because he wouldn't say blink and then use your intuition to make that call.
You know what? Keynes was actually a very great writer. So if you go back and read it now, it seems to be a little bit archaic because it was written in the 1930s. But he was actually one of the best-selling writers of his time. And in fact, he did it almost as well as Malcolm Gladwell. But it's a hard book to read, especially going back.
Right.
But animal spirits was a very good phrase, and what Keynes was worried about, one of the things he was worried about in his general theory was he was worried about the role of speculation. And so he has this marvelous chapter on the role of speculation, and Keynes would not have been surprised by what has happened in recent times. He wouldn't be surprised at this speculative mania where everybody bids things up. They applaud their animal spirits, and then he wouldn't be surprised that somehow the animal spirits changed, and then everything moved on the way down.
You discuss mainly five so-called animal spirits: confidence, corruption, fairness, yeah, money illusion, and stories. And I guess you think that confidence is especially important at a precarious moment like this, where we might either tilt toward recovery now or save our way through lack of confidence right into another Great Depression?
Yes, that's right. So confidence is very important. And confidence means is it's like this animal spirit story. It's how do you know whether to make an investment? Well, people have it in their gut. They're confident. When you're confident, actually what confidence means is that you trust people. And that's what happened in the very recent past. People were trusting all kinds of investments like subprime mortgages that they shouldn't have been trusting. They should have done a much more rational analysis of whether these mortgages were going to pay off, for example.
So does this apply? Could this apply now to the relatively optimistic stress test results we're expecting this afternoon, being kind of, you know, tilted toward the less dire to give private investors the confidence to get in on this bailout game?
Yes, I think that's what we're hoping is that confidence is going to return, and so when confidence returns, then I think the economy is going to begin to get better.
Of course, there has to be confidence in the credibility of the stress test results. I don't know if you have an opinion about that as an economist from what you've seen so far.
No, I won't comment on that.
Now, what about when officials talk up the economy rather than talk it down? We had John McCain lose the election in no small measure because he said the fundamentals of our economy are strong just after this meltdown began. And his advisor, Phil Graham, said we were in a mental recession just before. Now President Obama is in charge, and after saying things were really bad on the campaign trail, he's trying to sound more optimistic. And here is Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke speaking yesterday.
We continue to expect economic activity to bottom out, then to turn up later this year. Key elements of this forecast are our assessments that the housing market is beginning to stabilize and that the sharp inventory liquidation that has been in progress will slow over the next few quarters.
Now, I realize that your wife is the chairman of the Fed in San Francisco, so there are things that you can't talk about. But are these folks trying to help the economy by selling confidence? Does it relate to animal spirits in that respect?
I think confidence is important, and yes, I think we should, and it's very important that it be restored. But remember that the public is also smart, and the public, and so basically you have, just because somebody says it's something's true doesn't mean that people believe it. So I think our public officials tend to, what they do is they tend to tell what things as they see it, and that is, if I were a public official, that's what I would do.
Let's take another of these animal spirits that you write about on your list of five. Money illusion. That's intriguing. Yes. What's an example of money illusion?
An example of money illusion is, for example, when there's a lot of inflation and interest rates go up, then the stock market goes down. But the reason that that the interest rates have gone up is it's compensated for inflation, so there should be no change in the stock market. So that's one example. There's all kinds of other forms of money illusion. Sort of, I think when people get a salary raise and it doesn't compensate for inflation, then I think people tend to feel better, even though in fact the amount of stuff they can buy has gone down.
How did you know
that? People just like to get wage increases, whether they're fully compensates for inflation or not.
Well, here's another wage increase, really wage decrease example that we were talking about with Paul Krugman on yesterday's show. In his column on Monday, I don't know if you read it, he wrote about how it makes individual sense for workers in a company to take a pay cut so none of your fellow workers gets laid off if the company's in trouble. But if this happens nationwide, he says, it actually results in more unemployment in the long run. And here's a little bit of how he described why.
Everybody's income is down, but, you know, debts are not down. So people are owing just as much on their home mortgage as before, but they're making 10% less. And furthermore, to the extent that people think that there are going to be more wage cuts in the future, then who wants to spend now because things are going to be cheaper in the future? So it's like a rise in the interest rate. So between the debt effects and the interest rate rises, this, you know, economy-wide wage cuts actually makes everybody worse off.
Had you heard that theory before?
I know this theory. This is something that one learns from the studies of past depressions, that what happens when the general price level goes down is that the debts remain the same and in nominal terms, but people really owe more in real terms, and it makes it much more difficult for them to pay off their debts. So this is one of the problems of deflation.
Does it also relate to how human psychology drives the economy?
Yes, I think this is another way in which human psychology drives the economy. I mean, money illusion is actually very important in terms of and deflation. Deflation tends to be a bad thing because it means that more firms and are going to go bankrupt. More people are going to have a hard time paying off their mortgages. Farmers are going to have a harder time paying off their loans. And firms are having a harder time paying off those debts that they contracted, thinking the prices were going to go up or be constant.
George Akerlof, economist at UC Berkeley, Nobel Prize winner in economics in 2001, now the co-author of the book Animal Spirits, How Human Psychology Drives the Economy and Why It Matters for Global Capitalism. You can give us a call on any of this at 212-433-WNYC, Human Psychology and the National and Even Global Economy right now, 212-433-9692, or post a comment to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or a question for George Akerlof. How'd you know the president was reading your book? Did he tell you?
No, I didn't know that. It's nice to hear that.
is he? Do you think he's a behaviorist? You know, is he President B.F. Skinner looking for the right carrots and sticks to get us to change our personal habits for the national interest?
Well, I think I think especially macroeconomics. All good macroeconomics really is behavioral, because what we're trying to do is we're trying to explain why we deviate from full employment. And basically, if people just pursued their self-interest and it was easy to make trades, then in fact we'd always be at full employment. And the reason for that is, it goes back all the way to Adam Smith. The reason is that if somebody offers themselves on the wage, on the job market, and can add to product more than what they're asking to be paid, then there should be somebody who can go and hire them. And so that's why, in fact, we tend to have something fairly close to full employment all the time, most of the time. And then the real question is why there are deviations from it. And the reason there are deviations is because of all of these animal spirits. Should I talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, please.
We have times when there's overconfidence and people make investments, for example, that they shouldn't be making. Then there are times of too much pessimism when people are too pessimistic. There's the role of stories in the economy. So, surprisingly, I think most of us live our lives according to stories. We tell a story about ourselves. For example, in a marriage, there's usually a story about the marriage that's told by the husband and the wife. And somehow that's one of the great richnesses of a long marriage, is that people can look back and they tell these stories, and that's part of it. And the same thing's true about the economy. Usually at any point in time, the people have a story about the economy. So 10 years ago, it was the dot-com boom. A few years ago, people told a different story. It was the story that some kind of financial alchemy had grown up, fancy new financial markets, which could basically exercise the risk in the economy. And that story, you know, lots of people believed it. They went out and bought a lot of complicated financial products because they had this, they told this story and they were overconfident. Mm-hmm. And then, in fact, it turns out that that a lot of these assets were simply not sufficiently backed up.
Tim in Baldwin, you're on WNYC with George Akerlof, author of Animal Spirits. Hi, Tim.
How you doing?
Okay.
I read the book. I really enjoyed it. It connected with a lot of the stuff that I've been thinking and working on. I had just finished Keynes's tome, and I yeah. just found it very refreshing to get a very, you know, contemporary set expression of that particular. Call it something much more fundamental, though. I think it's what the Christian tradition calls original sin. It's what Freud calls the ego. It's that basic tendency to survive and how it plays out in human existence. When we feel, for example, that a Cadillac defends our sense of our being, it makes us worth living, or a Mercedes, or maybe a pool, or a trophy wife. We go after that with all the enthusiasm because it, like the gnat, we just want to survive. But we make it much more complicated. We don't. It's not just a matter of being swatted. We want to survive in terms of recognition, respect of other people, the quality of our homes, and so people are encouraged to leverage because now they have the possibility of meeting expectations that they have.
Right. It's culture. And, Tim, I think I get it, and we'll get a reaction from George Akerlof. Sure. Culture and animal spirits, expectations, status, peer pressure, all of those things, right?
Yes, yes. I think all of these play a very great role in terms of what people consume. And actually, we have a chapter in our book which discusses why people save and why they don't. And one of the most important things in saving is the culture. For example, a student of Bob Schiller's, who's my co-author, went to China and interviewed people as to why people in China are saving so much. And that, of course, is in contrast to what was happening in the United States at the exact same time, where people were saving almost nothing.
You make the argument that fairness comes into this because supposedly, you know, in business, fairness does not play a role. Companies basically try to maximize their profits and consider the marketplace to be the determinant of what's fair. But you make the argument that employers often pay more than they have to keep people out of a sense of fairness.
Yeah.
Do you think they really do that?
Yes, I do definitely think they do that. I mean, it in some sense, it's more they pay more than they have to get the people actually on the job. So there may be people looking for the job at those wages, but the existing employees, they want their employer to pay them a fair wage.
How do you explain?
And one of the reasons, that they work hard is because they think their employer is a good one and their employer is being fair to them.
Have you measured whether fairness is devalued in larger corporations? Their legal mandate is to maximize profits for their shareholders, and bosses seen as soft at the bargaining table might get eaten alive by their boards or their internal rivals. And we see sweatshops and moving companies to Mexico and then China, et cetera, et cetera.
I wouldn't. There's been a big study of this. I think that what's more, it's more surprising that you find fairness such as consideration in small firms, because small firms are usually in very competitive markets, where in fact they have to be very competitive. And yet, even in these small firms, we find that the employers find that it's very that they should pay fair wages to their workers.
And yet, I would think in small firms, the personal relationships among employers and employees would mitigate some of the rational economic concerns. Whereas in larger companies, it's just colder.
I think that larger companies have to do something for their workers, which indicates that they are doing something that makes them fair. Just if the atmosphere is colder, then in fact the wage, which is one way in which you can show your workers you care, is one way where firms can do that.
So
I think it's yet more important. And I think that large firms, on the average, do pay more than small firms.
So
the fairness does matter.
So before you go, what are maybe the top couple of ways that you think President Obama could apply the lessons from your book to avoid another Great Depression or boost the recovery as much as possible?
Well, I think we now know more about economics than we did in the 1930s, and we know what to do. So I think that that's a tremendous plus. There are two things that we need to do. We need to have two targets. We need to have a target for aggregate demand, which is via fiscal and monetary policy, to be at full employment. But then in addition, because there has been a collapse of a significant part of the credit markets, the government needs to have a credit target, too. We need to restore credit to the point where firms that do good, honest businesses can get the type of loans that they would if the economy were at full employment. And it's important to have these two targets. The reason that Hoover and Roosevelt never got out of the Depression is that they sort of didn't know what to do. They didn't know where to go. And now we know where to go. We need this. We need fiscal and monetary stimulus on the one hand, and we need to do everything possible to restore the credit markets. And when you go on a journey, the most important decision about that journey is where you're going to go. And I feel if Hoover and Roosevelt had known where they want to go, if they'd had a clear sense of this theory, then, in fact, they could have just gone there. It would have been difficult, it would have taken time, but we would have been out of the Great Depression really quickly. So now I think we know where to go. We have to keep our eye on the ball. We have to give the policymakers the leeway so that they can restore full employment in terms of demand and full employment in terms of what the credit markets look like.
Let's hope they're listening, and let's hope you're right. George Akerlof, Nobel Prize-winning economist from UC Berkeley, co-author now of Animal Spirits, How Human Psychology Drives the Economy and Why It Matters for Global Capitalism. Thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thank you. This has been a great pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the New York Times is getting more expensive. Are you like Shiva, our listener who posted on Facebook, who says, still worth it at $2? Or like Stanley, who writes, it feels like a suicide wish. Start calling now. Will you pay $2 for the New York Times if you've been buying it before, or will you just switch to the web? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Will you pay $2 for the Daily New York Times? 5 on Sunday.